She got an image of Adam running, then rising into the sky in a shaft of shimmering light. In return, she made an image of Adam in the light, then of herself in a coffin. She imagined Mike Wilkes closing the coffin with a bang. Then she said, "Take me with you," and imagined herself in a shaft of light going up. The blurring movement stopped. The condo suddenly seemed empty. Then she saw, in her mind's eye, Mike's phaeton pulling up down front. He was here. He was coming. But they were helping her. She blanked her mind as completely as she could. Immediately she saw a satellite photo of a small community, a big light in a field behind it. Then an image of a little boy. Not the one Adam had shown her, but another child. And Adam was standing behind him. Then Adam stepped forward and went into the child. For a moment they were superimposed on one another. Then the child threw his head back and got this look on his face of ecstasy. Or was he screaming? When he was quiet again, his eyes were like two headlights with fire glowing out of them. The vision was replaced by another one of Mike, this time in the lobby waiting for the elevator. She made an image of him blowing her brains out, which caused something to happen, a feeling of movement, in fact, of rushing. When she opened her eyes, the world was a blur. Then she saw the city wheeling below her, then the sky, its hard winter blue glowing. Then she heard a great crashing noise, and a building rushed up toward her. She stopped. There were water noises, and a man was sitting in front of her. He stared up at her, his eyes bulging. "What in hell?" She wasn't in her apartment. She was in a men's room, in a closed stall, face to face with a guy sitting on a toilet. She stared down at him. He covered his midriff with his hands. "Get out of here," he rasped. "Get out." Sorry, I took a wrong turn. She opened the stall and left the men's room as fast as she could. Behind him, she heard him yell, "What the fuck? The fuck? Hey!" She was in the Greyhound station. "Thank you," she said in her mind. "Thank you from the bottom of my heart." She hurried to the ticket window, bought a ticket for $25.50 cash, and immediately got on the waiting bus, which was due to leave in 4 minutes. The windows were tinted, which was good. There were already a number of other passengers, so she at least felt somewhat safe, as long as the guy in the men's room wasn't going to Dayton, that is. They had rescued her. Those weird, fierce little things. The only Greys she'd ever even glimpsed except Adam. They had been waiting for her there in order to save her. It was just awesome. Beings from another world were involved with her and they wanted her safe. And now she really began to feel better, because they were not about to be thwarted by Mike Wilkes. They had taken her in one of their vehicles. They must have. It had seemed, well, like flying. And it had been so damn wonderful because it had saved her life, and she began to laugh and cry at the same time. When she opened her eyes, an old man was right in her face.
"How'd you do that?" he asked.
"Excuse me?"
"You got in my damn toilet."
She thought quickly. There were other passengers around. "Sir, please."
"No! She come in my toilet, out of nowhere. She come in my toilet."
"I don't know what's going on," she said. The driver came back.
"Sir, you'll need to take a seat or get off the bus." "I was sitting there minding my own business and all of a sudden, wham! How'd you do that?"
The Greys obviously did not know the difference between ladies' and men's rooms. They dropped her in a place from which she could emerge without suspicion, except it had been the wrong one. The driver got the old guy seated toward the front and warned him against returning to the back of the bus. He'd just have to live with what he'd seen. As the bus started off, Lauren leaned back and closed her eyes, her whole body filling with a delicious relief. "You helped me," she whispered. "Thank you for helping me." An old lady smiled at her.
"He helps me too," she said. "Jesus helps us all. Isn't it wonderful?"
"Wonderful," she said. "Really, really wonderful." She had a couple $100 in her wallet, so she would not leave a paper trail. As far as her apartment and possessions were concerned, until this situation was brought under control, she was not going near them again. If Mike had the backing of the Air Force, then she couldn't escape anyway, could she, no matter what she did? So this was the best course of action. She would surface at Wright Pat and hope his powers were limited. The bus was running a bit early, so she found herself presenting a regular Air Force ID at one of the guard stations of the gigantic base before 8 in the evening. She was directed to the Wright-Patterson Inn, where she obtained a room. Rather than waste time and take risk, she at once called the law enforcement unit and reported Colonel Michael Wilkes's assault with intent to kill on her person. She stated her location and that she was slightly injured due to a blow to the face. She then went to the unit and filled out a complaint against Wilkes, getting more and more furious at him as she did so. The man had shot at a fellow officer. If she could manage it, she would see him in that secret Air Force detention facility he was always talking so much about, where they kept all the crooks with high-level clearances. Son of a bitch. One thing at least, she would no longer be working for him because his operation was over. No more Adam, no more detail. Great, as far as she was concerned. She'd had it with the whole mess. Let her get back into procurement, anything but this. But they'd told her 3 years ago that there was no exit. An air police captain came over to her. He was carrying her complaint form.
You're Colonel Lorne Glass?
Yes.
Lady, Colonel Glass is a KIA.
A KIA?
She died yesterday in a facility fire in another city, and I want to know what this is supposed to be about.
Her heart missed a beat. KIA. If he got that to stick, she was outside the context of the whole military infrastructure. No chance of getting him up on charges, no ability to use Air Force facilities or appeal for protection.
Ma'am, I'm going to need to ID you.
Did she have her credentials?
Yes.
She fumbled her wallet out of her purse, handed the card to him.
Excuse me, he said, taking it.
She made images of herself with a gun to her head, of herself lying in a coffin, but the Greys did not respond. It was the range issue again. Did they even know where she was? She heard a car stop outside the guard station. She went to the front and looked out the window. An awful coldness crept into her gut as Colonel Robert Langford's tall form got out and headed her way. Him. She had to run. She whirled. The desk officer was watching her, his eyes narrow. Behind him was another door. She strode across the room, passing the sergeant's counter.
That's off limits, Colonel, he said.
She broke into a run and got out the door. Where to go now? Ted's apartment was on base, but it was a good mile away. She took off down a sidewalk, heading toward a big hangar. At least there would be people around. At least when they got her, there would be someone to remember. Then she saw a general's jet sitting on the tarmac, its engines turning over. The stairs were down and two officers were talking at their base. The plane was either landing or taking off. She took a chance and went over to it. This isn't General Martin's plane, is it? She asked.
General Cerner.
Finally. As she went aboard, they barely glanced at her, then returned to their conversation. There were three officers in the plane, a full bird colonel, a major, and the general.
Sir, she said, saluting.
Colonel Glass, I need an urgent hitch to D.C. It's classified, sir, national security. He looked up from his seat.
I'm reading a lot of levels of bullshit in what you just said, lady.
Sir, it's extremely urgent.
Who's your commanding officer?
Sir, I'm not at liberty to tell you that, but I can commandeer this aircraft.
Don't give me that kind of guff. I've been in this Air Force a while, girlie. But what the hell, fellas? Who wouldn't want to take boobs like these to 30,000 feet?
She swallowed her outrage, managed to construct a seductive smile. Then she noticed something. He wasn't looking at her. In fact, his eyes were practically glazed over with fear. She turned, and there stood Colonel Langford with a pistol in his hand.
We'll take care of this, he said. Be my guest, the general replied. What the hell is going on? The major asked.
A prisoner is being taken into custody, Langford snarled.
Come on, Miss Jacobs.
He glanced past her.
She's not even Air Force.
She's pulled this hitch trick for the last time. My name is Lauren Glass, she said as he marched her out of the cabin. I am a colonel, and I've been listed as a KIA. I am alive. General, remember that when you read her obit. Colonel Lauren Glass is alive.
Don't even think about running, Langford said when they reached the tarmac. I'll have the air police on your tail in a matter of seconds.
She walked ahead of him.
You're a problem, he said.
A very serious problem. She felt the gun in her back. So the stories were true. Black Ops had their own special way of solving problems, and Lauren Glass, as the colonel had just said, was a problem. She thought with a curious sort of detachment that she had reached her last hours of life. It was a sickening, trapped moment, and yet oddly peaceful. She had avoided marriage, and now she regretted that. She'd never felt a child in her belly, nor the pain of giving birth. She regretted that, too. It was so very odd, this feeling. Not awful at all. The end of all responsibility. The end of the need to run. Too bad the Greys couldn't help her now. She tried sending images of her with Langford's gun in her face, but nothing came back, too far away. She wondered if he would kill her here at Wright Pat or take her somewhere else. Maybe it was even an official killing. Probably it was. So there'd be some stark room somewhere, and a steel coffin waiting. "I'm ready," she said. If he was planning to move her, maybe there would be a chance to escape. She might feel oddly peaceful, but if she could get away, she sure as hell would.
"It's going to be easy, then?"
"What choice do I have? You've got me."
"Yes," he said. "I do."
16. The moment he had realized that he'd lost not only Adam, but also the two handlers, Mike had raced back to Washington. There was only one way to fire somebody in an organization this secret. Nobody was retired. You were either actively involved in the trust, or you were dead. And Mike understood and agreed completely. You could not risk even a rumor getting out that mankind was on a death watch, or that there was an organization that planned to save only a precious few, or that any part of the U.S. government was involved with aliens. Not when there were such dire threats associated with revealing the secret of their presence. Mike explained to Charles Gunn how Andy and Lauren had gotten away.
"That was damn stupid."
"I don't think."
"Andy moved fast, you couldn't help that. But we'll pull him in."
"The empath is another matter, Mike.
He was stupid to shoot, but an asshole to miss."
"Charles."
"Shut up, I'm thinking."
"Charles, the Gray is at large."
His eyes fixed on Mike's face, his lips opened, then he closed them. He suddenly grabbed a pen and a pad of paper and started writing.
"Charles?"
The writing became scratching, then trenching, then he rose up like a tower and ripped the pad to bits. He rushed around the desk and loomed over Mike.
"God damn you."
"Charles."
"God damn you."
He paced then.
"I have to think."
"Do me, Charles.
Get it over with."
"Boy, that would be a pleasant way to spend an hour or so, you stupid piece of shit.
I've defended you, but you are fucking incompetent, you and that fancy house of yours. Your theft that I've ignored all these years, not to mention those special passes to the shelters that you've given your crook friends."
That would wreck him, to withdraw those bribes that were also such superb blackmail. His every defense industry contact would turn against him. He'd be a ruined man.
"Charles,
those people, some of them are essential."
"The hell they are. They're gone, history, and so are you, Mike. There's no way you're getting anywhere near one of the shelters. When this planet's environment collapses, you're going to be in the wind. You live with that now. You live with that."
By which Charles actually meant that he had just allowed Mike to live. He had expected to die in this room right now. Charles asked,
"Do you think Glass could be hiding Adam?"
"I went to her apartment first thing. No sign of anyone there. I think Adam's been recalled. The moment they realized that we were aware of the child, they pulled the plug."
"Because you asked the wrong question."
Charles dropped down behind his desk.
"They've got us in check here."
"They always have us in check.
We have to locate this child."
"It's in Wilton.
You know that."
Crew said they were signaling him, so he could play his role.
"We've got to scorch the earth then. Langford, Glass, Simpson, Crew. They've all got to be done, but first, find and kill that child.
We have this Oak Road group with a grand total of 6 residents under the age of 18, so that's our target. But we can't approach them directly, or we get the Greys on us like a bunch of infuriated hornets. The key is to identify the right child without getting so close to him that the Greys become aware of us.
We have the children's test scores, IQ tests.
Unfortunately, the school they all attend doesn't do IQ tests. Too elitist or too PC or some damn thing. They're all bright kids, professors' children. What about the public schools in the area? Their gifted and talented programs have 160 kids in them. Highest IQ is 160. We don't know how smart the Greys want their poster boy, so they're a possibility that needs checking. Let me ask you this, then. Do you have a plan? I think the child will reveal himself to us. How? He's got to be spectacularly bright. A freak-like.
What if he's ordinary? We have only that tape to tell us he's going to be some kind of genius. Maybe Crewe and Simpson knew you were listening. Maybe the tape is a lie.
Then we're already defeated, Charles.
Do you think that?
I think they're going to be mighty careful and mighty ferocious. Look what's riding on him, their whole species, and ours. Charles shrugged.
Don't tell me you're disloyal, too.
I've been to India, I've been to Vietnam. I've seen the brainless gobbling hordes of human filth out there. No, I believe in what we're doing with every cell in my body, Charles. This little band we call the Trust is the most noble, the most courageous, and the most important organization in human history. Charles gave him a twinkle of a smile.
You know what Stalin did when his little commissars were too eloquent in their praise? He had them shot.
Then do it, Charles. Get it over with.
I can't, goddamn your soul. You know that I've been defending you from Henry Verona for years, ever since CIA saddled me with him, in fact. If I tell the others just how royally you fucked things up, I'm going to end up sitting on a vote of no confidence, and guess who's going to join you in hell? No, Mike. I'd like to see you good and dead, I have to admit that. But I damn well can't, because the bullet that goes through your head goes through mine, too.
Charles, I'm going to fix this.
You'd better, because you were talking about the entire human species being enslaved, Mike. Because that is what this is about. Somewhere out there they're coming, and they will do this. They will do this, Mike. Just remember one thing. We have to get that child before they change him, because if we don't, God only knows what kind of abilities and powers he's going to have. I need people. I need backup. You can't have a damn soul.
Charles,
I can give you equipment, and I can give you money, but not people. The second I do that, Verona finds out and both of our throats get cut.
Mike had assumed that he'd have a trained team of experts, but he could see Charles's point all too clearly. Unless he fixed this and did it quietly, they were both dead men.
What's your plan, Mike?
I want to know your exact plan.
Forget Adam. Forget Glass, Langford, all of them.
Go for the kid now, fast, next 24 hours. Then worry about everything else. Use the TR to get me into Wilton with absolutely no chance of detection.
The Greys will know you're there.
Not right away. Remember, I've seen this mind-reading business up close for years. Distance is a big issue. They're not going to find me until I'm physically near the kid, but that's the one place I'll never be.
You're a sniper or what?
There will be no direct approach to him whatsoever. But he will be killed, Charles. Coming from me, I know it's not worth much to you, but I do guarantee it. To his credit, Charles made no comment. But the expression on his face eloquently communicated his contempt for what he undoubtedly regarded as outrageous braggadocio on the part of a proven incompetent.
You know how to access the TR?
Yes, sir. You'll recall that I set up the security. Charles turned around in his chair. The Capitol glowed in the distance, the Washington Monument beyond.
What do you think this'll be like in 1,000 years, Mike?
In 1,000 years? If we succeed, it'll be the holy city, the center of heaven. Charles said nothing more, and Mike took that as a signal to leave, for which he was very damned grateful. He had a good plan, and if he acted quickly enough, he thought there was a reasonable chance that it would work. The important thing was to push all consequences out of his mind. His life being at stake was bad enough, but looking at the larger picture was enough to freeze a man's soul. As he drove to National Airport, he called his personal travel agency and booked the next civilian flight he could, which was Delta to Atlanta. He parked in long-term parking, then went to the ticket counter and got his ticket. He bought a newspaper and went to the gate to wait until the agent arrived. He did nothing out of the ordinary. When the agent appeared, he checked in and selected his seat. Having set up this false trail, he then left the airport and hailed a cab, which he took to a small office building a short distance from his house. He descended into the garage, took out some keys, and started another car. This one was a Buick from the mid-80s, nondescript compared to the Mercedes he kept here in Washington. He drove to the Beltway, then took 95 up to Baltimore, exiting onto 695 toward Owings Mills. An hour and a half after he left the garage, he was exiting onto Painter's Mills Road. As he drove up Caves Road, he entered a more isolated area. He turned off onto an unmarked road and soon came to what appeared to be a construction zone. From here, the road appeared to be impassable. He took a right, and it turned out that what looked like brush was something quite different. The car moved through the brush and trees as if they weren't there, which indeed they weren't. This was a state-of-the-art holographic projection, one of the most advanced camouflage devices in the Pentagon's arsenal. The design had come from Adam. It was deployed sparingly, out of fear that the press would get wind of it. If the origin of any of these technologies was discovered, the whole deception would become unglued. The result of this was that certain select areas of military technology were stunningly ahead of public understanding. To accomplish his purpose, he would use an array of that technology. Central to his plan was a device that lay in a large underground hangar in these woods. Its development had taken 40 years. It had cost perhaps $250 billion, paid for by misuse of the gigantic criminal enterprise known officially as the Black Budget, which was really a cover for making select people rich at the expense of the American taxpayer by using national security to conceal the theft. The TR, or Triangular Aircraft, officially designated TRA-1, had also cost the lives of scientists who had come to a fatal eureka moment. When they realized that they were working on alien technology, they became too dangerous to be allowed to live. Test pilots had died too, perfecting its capabilities, as had engineers who had suffered mercury poisoning in the fabrication of its extraordinarily toxic power plant. The reason for the extreme secrecy was twofold. Not only did they have to protect this device from the public, they had to protect it from the Greys. They had gotten every kind of lie from Adam and Bob, most of them infinitely subtle, and as a result had gone down 1,000 blind alleys and consumed literally vast wealth. Indeed, so much wealth that every American citizen for the past 50 years had worked a fourth of his life in support of the development of technologies he wasn't even allowed to know existed, let alone gain any benefit from. He came to a certain spot in the narrow roadway where the radio, which he had tuned to an unused frequency, suddenly began to make a faint, high-pitched sound. He stopped the car, got out, pulled back a stone that lay at the roadside, and pressed his hand against the silver disc that had been concealed beneath it. A moment later, the small hill before him opened. He drove the car in. Inside, it was absolutely dark and silent. The only light came from a single red bulb, glowing softly. As Mike strode toward it, the outlines of an enormous object became visible immediately above his head. It was a triangle, totally black, measuring hundreds of feet on a side. Its power plant involved the rotation of a ring of a coherent mercury plasma at extremely high speed, reducing the overall weight of the craft by 40%. The rest of the weight reduction was accomplished with a very old technology. The triangle had to be as large as it was because, for the rest of its lift, it relied on helium. It contained the most sophisticated surveillance and camouflage technology known, but it was not much faster than an old-fashioned dirigible. Years ago, it had become obvious from Eamon Glass's talks with Adam and the stories told by Mr. Crew that mankind had lost a very sophisticated civilization to a ferocious war that was fought sometime around 15,000 years ago. The combination of the use of devastating weaponry and the rise in sea levels that had taken place when the last ice age ended 12,000 years ago had first pulverized and then drowned this civilization. It lived on only in myth, most notably in the Vedas of ancient India. But there was almost enough information there in the descriptions of Vimana aircraft to reproduce the power plants of the distant past. careful questioning of Adam and Bob had filled in the missing pieces of information. Large though they were, the TRs, of which there were 10 on the books and 2 off, were no more difficult to fly than a small general aviation aircraft. As Mike continued toward the faint red light, his head was just a few inches from the lower surface of the craft. The light marked the entrance, a simple hatch that was slid open by hand. He withdrew the ladder, which gave a bit under his weight as he climbed aboard. He took the long tunnel to the flight deck, pulling himself along on a stretcher as the crew had in the old B-36 bomber. This flight deck, though, was very different from what a bomber pilot from the 50s might have seen. It wasn't even meant to be flown by a pilot, but rather flown in by a reconnaissance expert. The plane all but piloted itself. Mike used a penlight to find the code panel and input the 33-digit code that activated the craft. A moment later, its amber control panel came to life. The basic aircraft instruments were there, of course, airspeed, bank and turn, altitude. There were others, though, that were not so familiar. Most of these involved the craft's extraordinary surveillance capabilities. Mike keyed Wilton, Kentucky into the autopilot. He pressed the 3 buttons that activated the plasma. Behind him, there was a distinct pop, the loudest sound the device would ever make. The altimeter began to wind up, but not far. It was a very unusual sort of altimeter because it could measure anything from thousands of feet to inches. The plane's operational altitude was essentially ground level. Unlike a cruise missile, it did not rely on comparing a picture of the terrain it was crossing to its memory. Instead, it had the intelligence and the instruments it needed to examine the terrain it was crossing and adjust its altitude accordingly. He watched the altimeter rise to 60 meters, then felt a slight shudder as the ship's propulsion system, which used the Earth's magnetic field, slowly began to impel it forward. It took 10 minutes for him to reach top speed. The craft sought out forests and mountains, only rarely slipping across a town and never a city. From 10 feet away, it made no sound at all. The flight from Owings Mills to Wilton covered 433 kilometers and took just over 2 hours. As Mike flew, he prepared instrument after instrument, most of them gained from his own hard work managing the empaths, extracting bits and pieces of information from his grays. Sound in the craft was as carefully managed as all other emissions. Even switches had been carefully damped so that pressing a button made nary a click. The fans that controlled the craft's altitude were entirely silent, designed so that the air they emitted was always exactly the same temperature as the air they took in. Just as it had no sound signature, and at night essentially no visual signature, it also had no heat signature, and no radar signature. Even the pilot's body heat was dissipated by being used in production of electricity. The TR could fail. If the mercury plasma malfunctioned, the craft would be incinerated inside of a second. During development, it had happened many times. There was never anything left, only ash drifting in the sky. In 1980 in Texas, some civilians had been close-up witnesses to one of these failures. One of them got cancer and filed a suit against the U.S. government, but the judge was prevailed upon and the case went nowhere. The civilian died soon thereafter, thankfully. He flew on. When he was within 30 miles of Wilton, he flipped another switch, and something happened that would have awed anyone who had not expected it. This was a technology that they had developed by analyzing the stories of a close encounter witness called Travis Walton, whom they had also discredited in every possible way, making a national joke out of him so that the public would never be convinced by his tale. Why the Greys had taken him on a ride was not clear, but they had. And on that ride, they had made their ship disappear around him, so that he appeared to be floating in the stars. Such a capability would be extremely useful for a reconnaissance craft, and Amon had gradually obtained from Bob knowledge of how to design materials that would change their opacity by the simple application of heat. He pressed a button, and was rewarded with the apparent complete disappearance of everything around him except the control panel itself. He floated now over the broad hills of eastern Kentucky, a man alone in the night sky. The ship was on a course that would take it directly over Oak Road. He had only to watch the world slipping by, 50 feet beneath his feet. He saw horses running in the moonlight. He passed over an elegant farmhouse and barns, so close that he felt as if he could have reached down and touched a weather vane. He smelled nothing of the night air, and felt nothing of the cold, because the temperature within the ship was carefully controlled. There was a heat signature, of course, but it was no greater than that of the breath of a swooping owl. The ship's voice said in his earphone, 2 minutes. He turned on the camouflage. This drained electrical power, but also provided an additional level of protection from notice from above and below. It consisted of thousands of tiny light-emitting diodes, served by cameras on the upper and lower surfaces of the ship. From below, an observer would see the night sky under which the ship was passing. From above, the image that was projected was of the ground. 1 minute. He saw light ahead, winking in among the trees. Soon a small neighborhood of tract houses appeared. He stopped the ship. Now he activated the infrared sensors, trained them on the first house in the tiny development. 2 adults, one registering 98.6, the other 97.9. An infant, registering 99.1. The ship was so low that it was buffeted by gas fumes coming out of the furnace chimney. He opened the house by activating the whole array of surveillance instruments. An ultra-sensitive receiver read the electroencephalograms of the occupants and provided a readout of their state, whether awake or asleep, and a level of awareness index. 1 adult was fully awake. 1 adult was registering mostly alpha, dozing according to the computer's interpretation. The infant was profoundly asleep. It seemed to him that he was not likely to be dealing with an infant, because this child would surely need to be at least fairly mature by 2012. He went to the next house. In it he saw 2 adults. Deeper in the structure was another person, perhaps a small adult, perhaps an older child. The 2 adults were physically motionless, but their minds were alert. He deployed the microphone system. He heard a familiar voice and for a moment was shocked. How could he know somebody in that house? Who would it be? Then he realized that it was Grissom. They were watching CSI. In the basement there was another sound, a continuous noise identified as a small electric motor. Could it be a shaver? No, it was moving over too broad an area. He visualized the movement and immediately had his answer. The person in the basement was using a model train set. Therefore, it was not a small adult, but a child. He moved to the other 2 houses then, gathering the structural plans into the computer, identifying approximate ages and sexes of the occupants. When he was finished, he had all the humans and all the animals. He then found the open space behind the houses that the Greys had used on their revealing foray. He dropped down into it. He wanted to step on the actual ground, but he must not leave the ship unless necessary. It had been designed to allow the occupant to reconnoiter on the ground, and was intelligent enough to protect itself, even for extended periods. But still, no chances were to be taken unless they were essential. He increased altitude to 1,000 feet, then went online again. Using Expedia, he found motels in Wilton. He input the address of the local Days Inn and was carried there. He then observed the local terrain for heights. It turned out that the top of a grain elevator was the highest point in the area. He flew until he found it, an enormous structure in the center of the small community. He went close. There, on one of the silos, was where he would place his antenna. Nearby, he saw a field. He dropped down. Putting the ship's remote into his pocket, he slid back along the access tunnel and climbed out. The ship would find a hiding place on its own. It would not go to altitude, but rather would hide just above the surface somewhere, probably back in the hills that surrounded the town. When he looked up, even though he knew that it was there, and not but a few feet overhead, he could not see it. As it departed, he felt the brief wash of one of its altitude control fans. He crossed the field, then walked into the lobby of the Days Inn. "Hey," he said to the sleepy clerk, "got a room?"
"Yes, sir,"
the young man said, coming out of the tiny office where he had been watching TV. Mike had a dozen false identities to choose from. He checked in under the name of Harold A. Hill, salesman. It was one of his favorites, because nobody ever wants to talk to a salesman. He went through the lobby and crossed a bleak courtyard to his room. He entered it, turned on the light, and used the bathroom. Naked now, he slipped into the bed. Tomorrow morning, he would scout the town for a radio shack. To complete his mission, he needed a few commonly available items. He lay down and closed his eyes. He was deeply tired. Deeply, deeply tired. Curse Lauren and Andy, who were both out there in the wind doing God knew what. The Greys were on the warpath, and extremely dangerous. He wished he was a damn fool salesman.